obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are all miracles to me. And I cannot believe how wonderful you look. And I am so happy to see a room full of people staying sober one day at a time. Today is our day, ladies and gentlemen. I want to first thank Cindy for believing that she could have the courage to ask a woman to be your speaker tonight. I worked on the first convention. This is the 27th. Lori, who is at the table with me here. My name is Linda, and I am an alcoholic. Woo! Lori and I worked on the first convention. My sponsor, Diane, who is here, worked on the first convention. Is there anybody else in this room that worked on the first Orange County convention? Carol? Okay? Not too many. You? Okay, good. We came up with the orange, didn't we? We came up with the orange. That's our mascot. I want to thank the entire committee. It takes a lot of people to put on something like this, and you've heard a lot of thanks tonight. God help me if I would forget to thank everybody. So thank everybody, whoever did anything. I am very, very happy that we have had good, strong Al-Anon participation at this convention, and young people. The young people are the next ones. They're the next ones that are going to be here. My sobriety date is May 2nd of 1978. I give all to the power that I believe in. I call that power God. I am a low-down, dirty, drunk woman alcoholic. I didn't ever have to get one day of sobriety, and I didn't want one day of sobriety because life was way too hard for me to deal with. It was too hard for me to try to have the feelings that I had to live in this world. I started in Beverly Hills, California. My father was a motion picture producer, more television than motion picture. My mother was a starlet. I come from a family of four. There were two from that father, my older sister Roberta, who lives in Arkansas. My mother remarried when I was five to my stepfather, and we moved to Pasadena, and two children from that one, my sister Deborah and my brother Michael. I am reminded of my father, who I still call Daddy, because they were divorced when I was so young. I just never did stop calling him Daddy. When I look at this ice sculpture, he took me to restaurants in Beverly Hills that had ice sculptures, and I see them very seldom now. And what a beautiful job you did, Marty. Thank you. So there were a lot of things that happened in that house in Beverly Hills that shouldn't have happened to me. By the time I was 3 years old, my parents were divorced when I was five, and we moved to Pasadena with that stepfather and lived in the big house there. He was also a very successful person in the eyes of the world, who's who in America, etc. I went to private girls' schools, and I went to Catholic boarding school. I was offered every opportunity for the good life as a young girl. However, there were many things that went on in that house in Pasadena, too, that I'm not going to talk about from this podium, but had a profound effect on me, and there was alcoholism. there were beatings for things like not finishing dinner with the rest of the family. That was my nightly thing that I got to do. Because I was so nervous about eating that my throat would close up and I couldn't swallow. And so I would go to the powder room and take that beating every night. I tried to do everything that I could when I was in school to make them proud of me. And so I'm reminded of Kay, who did such a beautiful job at the Al-Anon luncheon today. And I'm thinking about Maddie at the end of this table, who lost her mother this year. It was a beautiful lunch today, and I'm very grateful that I got to go. And also, I want to thank Tony for last night, who was much funnier than I'll probably be. So I did the best I could in that house, and I took one last hit when I was 15 years old. We lived in a huge house, and the kitchen was huge. And that stepfather of mine knocked me from one side of that kitchen to the other. And the next day, I left that house. I was 15 years old. I went to live with my best friend, Carol Troop. And I wish I knew where she was. Her mother showed me love. And I don't want to forget to mention the woman who was so instrumental in my life that showed me love, because I didn't feel love from my mother. And I loved her with all my heart. And I found out later she loved me, but I just couldn't feel it when I was young. I hated her in the same breath. But Ann Richardson, who probably is gone, I don't know where she is, but she was a person who did teach me how to love. And as far as I'm concerned, love comes from God. That's who God is to me. And so I left that house, and I went to live with Carol and her mother, who was fun. They had Marines and people from the Navy, guys from the Navy there, and we played pinochle, and they had a house in Belmont Shore. I'm a native Californian. I grew up and was raised here all my life. In Belmont Shore, they had a house, and we went down there and sailed and just had lots and lots of fun. I went back home when I graduated in 1958. I graduated from Pasadena High School at the Rose Bowl, and went back home that night. And was not well received. So it was a problem for me to be there. I went to one semester of Pasadena City College, where I was later to tell many men in many bars that I was the Rose Queen. When I would say I was from Pasadena, they would say, "Oh, isn't that where the Rose Queen's from?" And I'd say, "You're looking at her." Another drink, please. Oh, God, it's such a good memory. I forgot where I was. Anyway. I hope I didn't forget to thank anybody. Let's see. So I went to Pasadena City College, and then I started climbing in and out my window because I was seeing a football player that I wasn't supposed to be seeing. I was always doing something I wasn't supposed to be doing. And so I was sent to live with my aunt and uncle in St. Louis, Missouri, and that's where I had my drinking career began. I actually had my first drink. I was one of the boys in high school. I was always a tomboy. And so I ran around with them, and they all drank, and I didn't. So I went with them one time, and they fixed me a nice drink of vodka, about this much of vodka, and then they put a splash of Coke on the top. And I sucked it up, and boy, oh, boy, I'd never want to do that again. I was so sick. Sick, sick, sick. But now I'm in St. Louis, and I am going to school. I'm going to Washington University. I'm going to be a doctor. I'm living at my aunt and uncle's house. I'm taking liberal arts, but I'm going to be a doctor. I'm living at my aunt and uncle's house, and I'm riding my aunt's horse in the morning, and I'm going to Mass. Like my father wanted me to be a good Catholic girl, I'm going to Mass every morning in the beautiful cathedral there, and I am working at Famous Bar Department Store, and I'm going to Washington University at night. And then I meet my friend Lou. And Lou drank scotch on one rock. And I asked her to just take me, because I wanted to learn how to drink, because some nice gentlemen were asking me out to dinner and asking me what I wanted, what a beautiful little girl, what I wanted to drink before dinner, and I said, I don't drink. And they said, oh, you don't drink? You're just a baby. Well, God knows I didn't want to be a baby. So I asked Lou to help me, take me with her, and so I ordered my JB on One Rock. That's the kind of scotch she was drinking at the time. And I had about two or three of those that afternoon in St. Louis and walked out in that sunshine and just felt as good as I ever felt in my life. And I was not to ever stop after that. About 18 months later, me and half the army, the whole army was on that train, I remember that, took the train back to L.A., and the night that I went back, that sister I told you about in Arkansas picked me up at the train station. My parents were at a cocktail party, as they usually were. They went to a cocktail party almost every night. And Roberta picked me up, and I came home and went into my bedroom, and my parents were at the cocktail party. So, you know, in those days, you wore a full slip. We're talking about the 50s, okay? You wear a full slip. So I took off that suit I had on, and I was watching Elvis Presley, who was on Ed Sullivan that night, in that full slip, and they came home, and my mother jumped all over me for being out of my room without a robe. So the next day I left again, and I went to Hollywood. In Hollywood, I always wanted to be an actress or a singer, something very important. Hollywood is where I met my first husband. I met him at one of those Hollywood parties up on Mulholland Drive where all the little stars kids went. And we were married for 3 years. I do everything in threes, except to have kids. I don't have three kids. And I have had four sponsors. He had a really bad temper, kind of like that stepfather of mine. And so he started doing the same thing that my stepfather did, and I wasn't to understand until much, much later, until after I got sober, how I would happen to be with someone like that. You couldn't have told me. And so I know what it's like to be a battered woman, and by the way, I know what it's like to have pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. It's something that I don't ever want to have to feel again as long as I live. And I haven't forgotten that one day of the 33 years that I've been graced and had the grace and the mercy to be able to be here. Where was I? Mary. Oh, my first husband. Ha, no wonder I forgot. Anyway. So, you know, that was that. He had our disease, big surprise. And he was killed in an auto accident when I was 26. No, I think I was 24 and he was 27. We got married when I was 19. And so then I went to Las Vegas, where I decided to become a cocktail waitress. Because I didn't want to go to school anymore. School was very boring. And I figured I could make as much money as anybody else if I became a cocktail waitress in Las Vegas. And I did pretty good. It was before the big days. This was the 60s, the late 60s. So it was still a small community then. And I was still drinking. I met a man the husband is not with me anymore. I met another man in Las Vegas who was going to be a very important man in my life. He was a very important man in my life because he gifted me with a beautiful little baby girl, and that little baby girl is in this room tonight, and she's 43 years old today. She's the only person in this room that I know of that saw me drink. And she did see me drink. And I cannot ever take back what I dragged her through. She I can remember her coming and putting her hand on my head when she was 2 years old, bringing me aspirin. She laid next to me when she couldn't hear me breathing. She is the person that they were talking about at the Al-Anon luncheon today. She saw her mother in much more pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization than she ever deserved to see, than any child should ever see. And I cannot ever take that back, but I have been able to stay sober, and she hasn't had to see her mother drink since she was 9 years old. When she was 9 years old, I had my last drink. In the meantime, I'll just tell you a little bit more of my story. I went to New York. I lived in New York, right in the city, for 3 years, and I did very well there. I had plenty of money and did very well in New York City. I met Jimi Hendrix there. I met a lot of people in New York. I hung out in Harlem a lot. It was probably some of my worst drinking. I went to everywhere from the Village up to Harlem, where they had wonderful after-hours places, and there was a place that Wilt Chamberlain owned up there on 137th Street, and I used to love to go up there and dance and hear that music and buy things that they were selling out of the back of their cars, those trunks of their cars up there, clothes, you know. I had a great time, but I was very, very depressed in New York. And so finally, my friend Joyce, that had asked me to come to New York in the first place, she had bought Jimmy Hoffa's furniture, and I really wanted to see what Jimmy Hoffa's furniture looked like. So I went. Did I bring my water? Is that fine?
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
She met a guy who was playing in Fats Domino's band in Florida. We were in Florida. We had gone to Puerto Rico, and then we stopped in Florida on the way back. And the drummer needed someone she wanted someone to drive her car back to Las Vegas. She was going to move to Las Vegas. Are you following me? I don't know where I am. Anyway, I know where I am. I'm at an AA convention. Anyway, the drummer drove her car back, and I rode back with the drummer, who was to become my second husband. And he was from New Orleans, Louisiana. And we lived in Las Vegas, and where Christine was born. That's my daughter's name. And I did cocktails there. I was a pregnant cocktail waitress in Las Vegas, one of the first. 1968, she was born. And did the best I could with what I had, which was very little sanity. He was a very strung-out heroin addict, very strung-out heroin addict. And so we had a lot of turbulence, no beatings. This one did not beat me. We had a lot of turbulence and a lot of heartache, a lot of tears, a lot of desperation, something I'm sure everybody who has a seat in this room knows about. And after that, Christine and I moved to New Orleans. I lived in New Orleans, I think, about 3 years. She was in the first grade there. We lived in the French Quarter, of course, and she went to McDonald. Number 13, I think, something like that. Oh, turbulent life, ladies and gentlemen. Alcohol. I have alcoholism, and I love to drink alcohol, love to smoke cigarettes, love to be in those bars, tell those lies, listen to you. Even better, you should listen to me. So And I was buying my way into Alcoholics Anonymous without knowing. So we're in New Orleans for 3 years. Loved New Orleans. Loved the food. Loved the culture. Terrible drinking. Beautiful patios and outdoor places to drink in New Orleans. And we left New Orleans in 1973, I think. No, 1976. We came back to California. That was going to be the last of my drinking. I had 2 more years to drink. By the time I got back to California, all the flash was gone. I was now unable to get myself to a regular job. I became a house cleaner when I showed up, which wasn't regular. And I was arrested for the second time. I had been arrested in Las Vegas. I was arrested again in California for drunk driving. And that one was somehow let go, or in my head I let it go, I don't know. But I was arrested again 6 months later, almost to the day. That arrest was for felony manslaughter, drunk driving. I was in a blackout. I was a blackout drinker. I hit 2 people, 2 young kids, 16 and 17 years old. They were on a motorcycle coming out of the donut shop. And I still do not remember the accident. There was someone behind me who told me about it. There is a young, one of my good friends who couldn't be here tonight, whose name is Jackie. She was a dispatcher at the Huntington Beach Police Department that night. And someone else, Diane's sponsor, her name is Elizabeth. At the time, her name was Betty. She was the nurse at the jail that night. And I came to on my knees next to this young man that I had put down. I didn't know there were 2 people on the motorcycle. I came to, and I still have in my head what he looked like. He had blonde hair, and his head was bleeding. And so they put the cuffs on me, and I don't know how I stopped the car. I don't know how I wound up on my knees next to this young man. I can't tell you to this day. And that's been 35 years ago now. And I went to jail, and that little girl of mine got her own self to school the next day. And she called her grandmother, and her grandmother bailed me out of jail because of her granddaughter, not because of me. My parents were not speaking to me. They hadn't spoken to me for a long time. I had been an embarrassment to them, and they were ashamed of me. They had wanted me to be much more than I had become, and they expected me to be much more than I had become. And my mother bailed, with Christine's help, I don't know how she did it, bailed me out. And I was sent to a court program called Lucky Deuce. Lucky Deuce is not in anymore. I was sent to Lucky Deuce on my firstborn grandchild's birthday. She wasn't born yet. She wasn't born until years later, but that was April 29th. And I have told you that my sobriety date is May 2nd. So 9 months into this court program, I was thrown out because I had been sending them each month that my last drink was May 2nd, and they didn't catch it until 9 months later. And they asked me, are you sure that that's your sobriety date? I said, yes, it is. And they said, how do you know? And I said, I wrote it on my calendar. And they said, what did you drink? And I said, a margarita. And I was making margaritas on the blender that night. My second husband was there, my boyfriend was there, and somebody else was there. That little girl was there, and that's the last time she's ever seen me take a drink. That was my last drink. I was to have a profound spiritual experience that night, which has not ever left me. Of course, it's very personal to me, and it... I knew that if I did certain things that I wouldn't have to drink again. And to this day, that's been the case. We have one day at a time. If you're new in this program, we have one day at a time. I'm sure that it's difficult for you to relate to people who have a long time in sobriety, but really I'm no different than you are. I just have a little more practice. The fact is that that is the last drink that I took, and I went to court on crutches. I had fallen down and broken my ankle. So that when I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous, I need to tell you, I used to talk all the time, and I quit talking, and I always forgot to say this, and people would ask me after I talked, what happened to those people? Those people, by the grace of God, were both all right. They had contusions and abrasions only. It was an absolute miracle. And I have to tell you, there have been many, many miracles in my life. I couldn't even go into them. I have been at death's door many times this far away, from guns, from knives. My life has been threatened many times. I lived pretty dangerously when I was drinking. And I had no fear when I was drinking. So I didn't back down under any circumstances at all. That Irish blood would float up in me, and boy, I was ready for a fight. Anybody who wanted to come up to me, I am ready. By the way, I'm trying to learn to kickbox now, and I am 71 years old. Anyway, so there's no stopping some people. I was a fighter then. I have settled down quite a bit now. And I was sent to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous by Lucky Deuce. And I understood, that's why I told the truth. I understood that I needed to be here one day at a time, that that court program was only going to be for 15 months. And when I was sent to you and went in on my crutches with my court card, in those days, in 1978, when I got sober, they talked about people with a court card like you were a low-down dog. I didn't want anybody to know I had a court card. I just would sneak up to the secretary after everybody left and have them sign my court card. And I didn't find out until much later that a lot of people that had court cards signed their own cards. It never even occurred to me. And that is the grace of God, because I am a genius, you know. You would have think that I would have thought of that, but no. Anyway, I heard what you said. I heard what you said here at Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard when you said that my chances were going to be for insanity or death if I didn't stay here. And I heard when they read, rarely have we seen a person fail that has thoroughly followed our path. I thought, oh, my God. If I don't figure out what their path is, I'm not going to make it. And so I started going to meetings, and I was on welfare by then. I was still scrubbing toilets when I showed up to do that. I was a long way away from how I started. And I had a mouth that was absolutely, positively awful. Every other word out of my mouth was not attractive. And I'm still able to do that today, but I try not to do it from the podiums. I still have that talent. Some things don't leave us. And I keep losing my place. Huh? Bad mouth, but before that, where was I?
Getting sober.
See, that's why they don't let women be a banquet speaker. I was getting sober. Oh, rarely have we seen a person fail. What the heck? Oh, my God. And so I heard that. And I heard all the other things that you were saying. I heard you say one day at a time. I thought that was a... I heard that. I mean, I thought that every day. I was always had lived my life one day at a time. Like I was going to die the next day because I wanted to be dead. Especially at the end of my drinking. And I heard when you read all the things that you read. And I listened to the people. And I came to believe that it was going to be a lot of hard work here. It is 12 and 12 this year in 2012. We have 12 steps. That's at the personal level. We have 12 traditions. That's at the group level. And we have 12 concepts. That's at the world level. And we have 12 promises, ladies and gentlemen. And thank God we do. Because it lets us know, and I was so glad when I heard, when I heard no matter how far down the scale you have gone, And when I heard all of the promises, it just meant the world to me, because I looked to them to be my hope and to be my breath and to be my sanity. I knew that I was nuts, but I didn't know how nuts I was. By the time I was 3 months sober, I heard people say that you shouldn't make any major changes in the first year. And so that is the thing that I did do. I did make a major change, and I went home with a nice young man who took me to his house and asked me what I wanted to drink, and I just sunk. My heart just sunk. And he must have seen the look on my face and said, I have grape juice and I have water, and what would you like to drink? And I said, I'll just take water. The result of that friendship is sitting next to his sister in this room. He's 32 years old, and his name is Rick. And Rick and I were newcomers together. That's my boy. God, I love him. That boy and I were newcomers together. He has 1 year less than I do. And I have to tell you how helpful he was to me, because I watched his progress. I watched him crawling, and I watched him trying to take his first step and eat his food. And I knew that I couldn't ask too much for myself, because we don't ever think we're doing it fast enough, do we? I wasn't moving fast enough in this program, but when I would look at him, it would put me right back into how I truly had to start here, because I had to start all over again. And I want you to know that I am the same person who came in on crutches, that I do have all the same character defects, but I have learned how to have a different reaction to life. It's been extremely important to me to learn that. And I learned that God gets the glory, that God is the power, that of myself I am nothing, that faith doeth the works, that the truth will set you free. And so I became unafraid to tell you the truth. I wasn't afraid to tell you who I am and where I had come from. And if you didn't like me, that was going to have to be your problem. And I was pretty, I have to say, my friend Susan called me Susan. I called her, she's Chinese, and she would say, my name's Susan. And Susan and I got sober at the Costa Mesa Llano Club, and she was in as many meetings as I was in, and she lost her children. And she went to Jehovah's Witnesses, so she doesn't go to meetings anymore, but she called a couple of weeks ago and said, this is Susan. And I said, hi, Susan. And she said, oh, your voice. And I thought, what about my voice, Susan? And she said, not harsh anymore. And I started crying. I cried a lot of that afternoon. Because she saw me when I was brand new, and I was very angry. I thought that you were all just a bunch of drips, you know? Just really didn't like you, didn't want anything. You said, if you want what we have, I wanted nothing that you had. Whatever it was, I didn't want it. And when I saw you run up and get those chips, I thought you were the biggest drips in the world to want to run up and get a chip. Oh, my God, I was way too sophisticated for that. No chips for me. Raise my hand as a newcomer and you're going to talk to me? I don't want to talk to you. I'm not raising my hand as a newcomer. Do not talk to me after the meeting. I got nothing to say to you. I don't want to be in these meetings. I'm just here because I'm just an alcoholic and I have to be here, but I don't want to talk to you. So I made it pretty clear to people, and people just sort of nodded at me. And the old timers, Lois, I see you over there. The old timers would tell me to keep coming back. That's all they would say to me, keep coming back, Linda. I didn't know they told everybody to keep coming back, because it made me feel kind of good. yeah, I thought I was special. And I met people who were to become very important to me. My first sponsor's name was Thelma. Thelma was half Indian. She was perfect for me. She was old. She was tired. I knew she wouldn't tell me to do anything, and she didn't. She said, you know, Linda, I think you're doing great. And I'd be sitting in meetings with strangle marks around my neck because that guy I was with was a Vietnam vet, and he had some problems that were left over from Vietnam. But I will be forever grateful to him because he yelled and screamed at me, and that's the only language I understood. If you talked to me like I was a human being, I didn't understand you. I was an animal when I got sober. I was really, really lost. And he got in my face and told me that if I didn't write a four-step, I was going to die. He also told me when I was pregnant that I wasn't pregnant, that he'd never seen a pregnant woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, you're looking at one now, buddy. So, and my daughter, I have to say, has not met her father. His name is Bobby Jones. He's not the golfer. If he's anywhere, let me know. She hasn't met him to this day, and he's from Oklahoma somewhere. That's how I lived. I wasn't a conformist. However you were supposed to live, I didn't live that way. And I paid some big prices for it, and so did those people that were in my life. I didn't give them credit until I got sober, but they paid huge prices. And those children, although Rick's never seen me take a drink, but those children, you know, I did have a little temper. His sister had to save him a couple of times. when he was 16 years old, he was coming down the stairs, and I was going to another meeting. I got very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me that I was sicker than others, and those that are sicker than others are going to have to do more service work. And so I did a lot of service work. And one day, my son was coming down the stairs. He was about 15 years old. And asked me where I was going, and I said I was going to do whatever service thing I was doing. And he looked at me and gave me a dirty look, and I said, what's wrong? Aren't you glad that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous and that I'm sober? He said, as a matter of fact, Mom, I hate Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought about that, and I thought, of course he hates Alcoholics Anonymous. It takes his mother away from him a lot. I had to do a lot of hospital and institution work. I went to the Orange County Women's Jail. I was telling Billy that I did a little general service. My sponsor, Diane's very involved in it, and she tried to get me to do it, but I did a lot of work in hospital institutions, and I want to tell you about some of the women that I sponsor. The first two women that I sponsored are gone. One of them, all the girls and I got together and gave her a service. We were the only people at her service. She didn't have any family. Her name was Candy. And the girls that I sponsor today know about her. I tried for over 20 years to help this girl, and she just couldn't get it. She would have it for a little while, and then she'd lose it. And I would try again, and she would try again. And we did the best we could. And one day, she was lying in the hospital in Westminster, California. And I went to see her and looked in those big brown eyes of hers, and she said to me, I went too far, didn't I, Linda? And I said, I hope not, Candy. But she had gone too far, and we took her to another hospital, and that's where she died. The other one, Gloria, I just found out had cancer and died in December. So those were my first two 12-step calls. The next one was not a 12-step call, but she was the first person who stayed sober, and her name was Chris. Chris B. She doesn't go to meetings anymore, but she still keeps in touch with me. And I told her, if you want to stay sober, don't ask me to be your sponsor, because everybody who asks me does not stay sober. So if you really want to stay sober, get somebody else. And she said, I don't want somebody else. I want you to sponsor me. And I said, okay, we'll try. And she did. She stayed sober. She was the first person that I sponsored that did stay sober. Since then, I have had so many more, and many of the girls are here tonight. I want to talk to you about my other two sponsors. The second one that I had, his name is Janice. Christine and Richard and I lived at Janice's when I was 2 years sober because I could not pay my rent in the apartment that we were living in, and I was just... This then, trying to get off welfare and food stamps and get out of that awful, banged-up, primered car that I had that my daughter stayed on the floorboards of. She was so ashamed to be in it. I had to drop her off two blocks away from school. Janice, I used to not be able to mention her name without crying because she went so over and above for me. She brought us groceries just out of the blue when we were going to be probably eating oatmeal that week. She took us into her house. It was actually her husband who did that. And we stayed there for 5 months, me and my two kids. I had gone to meetings and said I didn't know what I was going to be able to do with my kids, and nobody offered to take us in, and I just, you know, was very discouraged, and I just thought I knew it. Those people in Alcoholics Anonymous don't care. They never did. And I was very discouraged. At 2 years of sobriety, I was starting to get a little more suicidal again. But they took us in, and we stayed there. And Janice told me things like, for God's sakes, Linda, you don't have to rehearse to be yourself. And she told me things like when I was going to go on my first panel, and it turned out that the Academy Awards were going to be on that night, and of course, because of my father, I had not ever missed an Academy Awards. And there was a movie producer called Cecil B. DeMille. Many of you are probably too young to know who he was, but I told her I wouldn't be able to go, and she said, well, the next time you need some help, call Cecil B. DeMille, Linda. Needless to say, I went to that panel. They didn't have Tebow then. So, because I understood that my sobriety had to come before anything, and I still understand that today, and that's one of the reasons that I'm standing here tonight. And I cannot tell you, the women who are in this room tonight, how much you guys all mean to me. Several of the women that I sponsor are here tonight, and they are a lot different than the early women that I sponsored. The early women that I sponsored, half of them were mentally ill. They had everything you could think of. Overeating, undereating, incest, everything. They were just, and then none of them had jobs. You know, they were kind of like their sponsor. We all smoked cigarettes, loved smoking cigarettes, all of that stuff. And the girls that I have today are all women who are working hard at jobs, at careers. And they have sent me messages all day today. Messages of love and prayers. They have done way more for me than I could ever do for them. And I will be forever grateful. I see your shining faces out there. And I see Camille, who, you know, I used to talk a lot. I quit talking at 10 years of sobriety because my ego had gotten very swollen. And so I stopped talking and I went back to my home group to make coffee. And I did that for a long time. And when Cindy asked me to talk, I really thought that she had the wrong number, but I believe that it was something that God wanted me to do, and so far, I'm glad that I can do it. But the fact is, Camille reminded me, my girls used to have to drive me around. I went 2-3 nights a week, you know, all the time I was talking, up and down, and everywhere. And Camille reminded me one time she was going to be my 10-minute speaker. I always took my girls with me to be my 10-minute speaker. And she was all worried about what she was going to say. And she just couldn't believe that she was going to have to talk for 10 minutes. And I was thinking, my God, I got to talk for 40 minutes. And you're worried about talking 10 minutes? And by the way, what in the hell makes you think anything you have to say is going to be important, Camille? That important. I was just trying to make her feel more relaxed. Oh, I was very hard on my girls when I was new. Now I'm not. Now I understand that no human power. I really understand what that means. So I try to, and I get to, love them. And they have given me so much love in return that I am full up tonight. I have told you that I believe of myself I am nothing. I believe that I don't have the ability of myself to be here with you tonight. I have told you how much I loved to drink and carouse and do everything that went along with it. And I didn't think that there was ever going to be any other kind of life for me. That mother of mine that I told you about that didn't want to talk to me got ill, and she called me, and she wanted me to come. And that's the same mother who, at 3 years of my sobriety, called me on the phone and told me she was proud of me. And I got off the phone, and I cried, and I cried, and I cried. I hadn't cried for 3 years, I don't think. And I was crying because it didn't matter anymore. I didn't need her approval anymore. I had needed and wanted her approval my whole life, but it didn't matter anymore. I had yours, and I had God's, and I knew I'd be all right. And so when she wanted me to come and be with her, I did that. I quit the job that I had, and when she lived in Montecito, which is a beautiful place, so it was pretty easy to go there. And I would go back and forth on the train and be with my mother. And she got dementia. We played cards. We played a game called Spice and Malice. Spite and Malice, I don't know if you know, any of you know, it's a great game. We played that a lot and went to nurseries. And, you know, she had someone there cooking for her. It was nice. And she had had a stroke. And so she didn't want any heroic measures. And so we brought her home. And I threw myself across her bed and said, "Mom, you said you didn't want any heroic measures, and so we're not going to give you any." The stroke had rendered her unable to speak. And she was a beautiful woman, and she still was a beautiful woman. And I threw myself across her bed and told her how much I loved her and said, "Mom, you asked me, you told me you don't want any heroic measures. If you've changed your mind, you need to let me know." And that woman looked at me with more love than I have ever seen in a pair of eyes in my entire life. And I knew then that my sisters had told me the truth, that she did love me, that I was mistaken, that when I thought she didn't, she did. And so I was able to be there with her. My daughter presented me with a baby girl who is now 17 years old. Her name is Caitlin. She is a soccer player, a very good soccer player. And I did not think that I was good enough to ever even be allowed to have a child, much less a grandchild. I thought that I was very dirty, and I was garbage, and God wouldn't give me a child. And so when Caitlin came into the world, I was so happy, but I was working at Jan's Health Bar, and she wouldn't let me off, and so I couldn't be there for Caitlin's birth. And she just has gotten a scholarship to Marymount in Palos Verdes for soccer, but she can't play because now, right after she got the scholarship, she threw her knee out for the third time. So she's wrecked both ACLs and meniscus and whatever else you can wreck in your knee. She still wants to play, and the coach still wants her, and she got, academically, she's still going there, so that's great. And then the next grandchild was Johnny, and Johnny is 13 years old. He's going to be 14, and Johnny plays golf and gets straight A's, and he's a very, very interesting, wonderful human being. And then my son presented me with two children, a girl and a boy. The 10-year-old little girl, Destiny, is in gymnastics. She's an A++ student. She was just born with the ability to just be natural, you know, very even-tempered. And then her little brother, Christopher, who was 5, and they come down every weekend, and I got to sleep with Destiny last night, and, you know, it's what I'm trying to tell you is that my life is completely different than I thought I wanted or that I ever could have hoped to have. I was able to get a house with the help of that mother of mine right at the ocean in Newport Beach. I had I know what it's like to live in a room with a bathroom down the hall. I know what it's like to be in dirty, grungy hotel rooms. I know what it's like to not be able to pay your rent. And I knew what it was like to live in a nice house in Newport Beach, too, but I didn't think I'd ever have one, and I do, with a swimming pool and a spa. 2 blocks from the beach, ladies and gentlemen. You are looking at a miracle. So my life is full today. The women that I sponsor, we have a meeting every month in my house. We all bring food, and we go over one step each month. I have new women in my life, women with one day. She came up here and took a book. And I pray to God that she gets all the prayers that she needs and all the hope that she needs. I love the people who struggle, who come back, who don't give up. There's always hope. I am not a person who scorns newcomers. I love the newcomers, and I pray for you. And I know that you can't do it by yourself, and I hope that you know you can't do it by yourself, but we can do it together. And we can do it, and you can do it the same way we do, and that's one day at a time. I am a crazy person, and I will always be crazy. So it's not possible for somebody like me to get here, and it's certainly not possible for somebody like me to stay here. And that's why God sent me here the way he did, with that court card hanging over my head and knowing that I could have killed 2 people. That helped me to stay here. But that spiritual experience helped me more. And then you carried me. Lois over there, who was my friend Annie's sponsor, inspires me. You people inspire me. I am inspired by you, and I thank you for that. I think that I've talked enough. I think that I've told you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I hope I have. I want to thank you for your attention. I want to thank you for letting me look at you and see how wonderful, when we think of how this program started, and here we are, and we're only one room. There's another convention going on in San Diego, and there's conventions all over the world and people all over the world today. And, you know, we can't do it alone. I can't. I need you. I need you as much as I ever did. My sponsor, Diane, allows me to call her once a week, and she reminds me if I don't. She says, she'll send me a text, "Did you forget that it's Tuesday?" I call her more, but I have to call her once because I have to be accountable. I have to be accountable to another human being. I am a wild and crazy girl, and I have a head that's really, you know, a little wild, which is a polite way of saying it. So I am grateful for what she has given me. She taught me about commitment. She told me that she didn't think that they should all have to do something that I didn't have to do, that I should be able to get to the meetings on time like they did, that if I said I was going to do something, that I should show up and do it. Because, you know, when you have no self-worth, it doesn't really matter if you show up, does it? I mean, who's going to miss you? You know? But so there was a lot that I had to learn. And I have learned a lot here, and I have learned how to put it into action. And I know that you guys know how to dance and sing and be entertained, and that's the next thing that's coming up. Before I get down, I want to thank God for all he gave me. I want to thank God again for all he took away. And most of all, I want to thank God for all he left me. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.